She didn't have time for housekeeping. She was helping struggling families to keep their children. She wished Mietek could see why it mattered so much. Mietek just wished she would focus on their family for a change. The gulf between them was growing deeper, and the fire had already gone out of her youthful marriage. They were left with an awkward kind of old friendship. It wasn't that Irina didn't love Mietek, but he was not her passion. At the Mother and Child Center, Irina felt a deep sense of purpose. Everyone here was dedicated and true to their goals. Everything that I had been taught seemed to come to use, Irina tried to explain. She was also making interesting new friends every day among Dr. Redlinska's other students and employees. The work environment, she said, was very nice. And so were the people. She saw a lot of one person in particular, Adam. Chapter 2. Dr. Radlinska's Girls, 1935 to 1940. The lecture was over, but still the professor didn't move. The students on the left side of the lecture hall stood still for a moment longer, too, motionless and breathless. Irina was among them. She was 25 years old in the autumn of 1935, and, less than 5 feet tall, was shorter than the rest of the crowd. But no one who knew her doubted that Irina had some outsized political opinions. Those few seconds stretched on slowly. Everyone in the lecture hall waited. A sudden movement from the right, and the rush of air as body met body came like a collective exhalation. Irina saw the flash of green ribbon pinned to the young man's jacket. The end of his raised cane shimmered in the light. Razor blades. The villains had tied razor blades to the end of the canes they had brought to beat them, Irina realized. A scream erupted from one of the girls nearby, followed by a surge of motion and the sound of brass knuckles hitting bone. The melee once again had started. Now the fist and the brass were raised up in front of Irina. To her side stood a Jewish classmate, a young man with dark, curly hair and glasses, and one of the men with green badges raised the cane overhead and barked to him, "Why are you standing?" He answered steadily, "Because I am Jewish." Turning to Irina, the hooligan demanded, "Why are you standing?" Irina was fearless. Friends worried about how fearless she could be. Her more hidebound professors lamented that her youthful idealism was so insistent and so defiant, but Adam loved both parts of her character. Her bold retort now was designed to infuriate the angry young man in front of her. Their eyes connected. "Because," she snapped, "I am Polish." The brass fist smashed into her face in retaliation. She felt warm blood and then the darkness. What ignited the riots on the University of Warsaw campus in 1935, when Irina and Adam were graduate students, was the informal institution of a bench ghetto, a seating area in the lecture halls for Jewish students that was set apart from the area for the so-called Aryans. The far right wasn't growing in power only in neighboring Germany. Poland also had its problems. As far as Irina and Adam were concerned, the biggest of those problems was an organization called the ONR, the Obóz Narodowo-Radikalny, or National Radical Camp, an ultranationalist and right-wing political group whose violent tactics and racist rhetoric were gaining traction and intensifying ugly feelings of anti-Semitism. The ONR supporters proudly displayed their political affiliation by wearing green ribbons. "The bench ghetto is an outrage," Irina and Adam and all their friends fumed when they said it. Jewish students and their supporters on campus staged angry and impassioned demonstrations, refusing to sit at all during lectures. Some professors ordered the rebellious students to leave the lecture halls. Other professors supported the students and delivered their lectures standing in solidarity. As Irina put it simply, "The years at the university were for me very hard and very sad. a rule was established at the university, segregating the Catholics from the Jewish students. The Catholics were to sit on the chairs to the right, and Jews on the chairs to the left. I always sat with the Jews, and therefore I was beaten by anti-Semites together with Jewish students. But what mattered was that it was together with Adam. Adam was fascinated by this ferocious wisp of a woman, and, as Irena's family later testified, their love affair continued even though she had married someone else. At the University of Warsaw, an old-fashioned place at heart, the majority of the campus tacitly supported this discrimination against the Jewish students. Across town, at the Polish Free University, however, things were different. When the ONR thugs came to assault Jewish students there, the entire campus rallied and drove them off with fire hoses and catcall hisses. Dr. Radlinska and the young women in her programs, Irena included, joined the protests and the scuffles. It was exhilarating. At home, Mietek grimaced sourly. He fretted over her safety, but he also worried about whom this new person, this risk-taking activist, was that his wife was becoming. Irena's new friends from Dr. Radlinska's circle were talented and high-spirited young women, and most of them were Jewish-born, although, as left-wing activists, religion didn't much interest any of them. One of her favorites was Alla Golam Grinberg, a nurse at the Jewish hospital on Dvorska Street, who worked closely with Dr. Radlinska's cousin, Dr. Hirschfeld, in studying communicable diseases. Alla's maiden name was Golomb, but she was 6 years older than Irena and had been married for years already to a Jewish actor and school principal named Arik. Their friends were exciting people, cabaret singers, actresses, and other performers. Dr. Korczak sometimes invited Alla to speak at his lectures because everyone knew Alla was a hands-on expert in obstetrics and sanitation. Irena found her friend inspiring, and sometimes even a bit intimidating. But Alla was also a funny and fun-loving eccentric, a sharp, angular person with a sarcastic sense of humor and a terrible fashion sense, whose mannish clothes never quite seemed to fit properly, and whose wiry black hair always managed to look wild and untidy. Another new friend, Rahela Rosenthal, on the other hand, was drop-dead gorgeous. Rahela was training in Dr. Radlinska's program to be a teacher, and she was lithe and blonde. Men stopped on the streets to talk to her, and often she chatted back because everyone knew Rahela had a bubbly personality. Irena was pretty, in a plump and quiet sort of way, but men didn't turn on the street to watch her pass, and her wit was, she had to admit, drier and more abrasive. The third member of their circle was Eva Rechtmann, a language student working with another professor they all knew well, the jovial Dr. Vladislav Witwicki. Eva was immensely clever, and everyone said she was one of the most talented scholars in the graduate program at the Polish Free University. But Eva had no hard edges. She had a head of dark, tumbling curls, and her quiet, lilting voice made everything she said sound like a lullaby. After work or sometimes a lecture, Irena put off going home a bit longer and stopped off with the girls at a cafe for a coffee or an ice cream and a few laughs. Young women in those days dressed fashionably in low-slung heels and brightly patterned dresses, and her new friends thought nothing of smoking cigarettes in public. Irena had long since abandoned her youthful scouting pledges. She also no longer felt any need to rush off to confession, simply because the thought of Adam made her heart race faster. Irena's hair was cut in a wavy bob that, by then, was no longer scandalous, just practical. She had bright eyes that her friends remembered as startlingly blue, and a smile that looked more than a bit like mischief. The other young women were all from Jewish families, and they howled with laughter to hear a Catholic girl like Irena say something in Yiddish. They would also talk politics, of course. Their work was focused on social justice. The Polish Free University was still a center of radical activism, and Irena's new friends were ardent socialists like her father. Occasionally, she would meet someone whose politics went a bit further. I met a few illegal members of the Polish Communist Party right after their spending time in prison, Irena confessed. She thought they were smart, noble people. Adam flirted with communism himself, and perhaps that was part of his allure. When, as the only child of an extraordinarily rich family, he inherited the largest share of his father's fortune in the 1930s, his widowed mother, Leocadia, was aghast at his plans. He planned, he told her boldly, to give it all away to charity. Leocadia wept and pleaded and scolded, but Adam just dug in his heels. The money has to go, he told his mother. Adam had struggled his whole life with the curse of wealth, and he didn't believe in inheritances. Neither did new communist friends of theirs, Stanislav Papuzinski and his daring political girlfriend, Zofia Wojciechowska. They lived together and even had a small son already, but they didn't have any plans to get married. Marriage was a bourgeois institution, and they were bohemians. Irena found it all enchanting. When it came to leftist politics, Irena had an impeccable family pedigree after all, and her new friends knew it. Her father had played an important role in the creation of the Polish Socialist Party, and there were still party members across Warsaw who remembered Stanislaw Krzyżanowski. And no one spoke of Irena's father more fondly or more often than Helena Radlinska, who had known him personally. Helena and her ex-husband Zygmunt had been founding activists in the Polish Socialist Party in the early 1900s, and Zygmunt, a doctor at the University of Warsaw Hospital, had worked alongside Stanislaw Krzyżanowski. For Irena, who never stopped missing her father's presence, it was all a kind of profound homecoming. She joined the Polish Socialist Party herself, and I fit right in with my political past, Irena said. Unfortunately for Mietek, she had found her true family. She was moving further and further away from her shaky marriage, and closer to Adam and her new friends in Dr. Radlinska's circles. She was also becoming more politically engaged than ever. That meant doing, not talking. What can be done? That was always the question Irena asked herself. She looked at her campus identity card, stamped with the word Aryan, and it made her furious. She scratched out the word and boldly presented it on campus as a silent protest. When the campus administrators learned of her rebellion, however, they decided they had had enough of this petite rabble-rouser and her presence at the University of Warsaw. Irena was slapped with an indefinite university suspension. It would be years before she would be allowed to return to classes. Mietek might have been forgiven for feeling a bit relieved to learn that his young wife's boisterous and bruising days as a campus agitator had reached an abrupt administrative conclusion. Perhaps he already suspected that her heart was with Adam. Perhaps he was too tired of the quarrels for it to matter. But in the way of failing young romances everywhere, it's likely he clung for a while to the hope that she would return to him and to her senses. When the news came that year that Dr. Radlinska's mother and child center had to be shut because it had run out of community funding, and that Irena's job there was ending too, it seemed like a perfect chance for Irena to settle down at last and have children of her own. After all, Irena was already in her mid-twenties. At any rate, Mietek was soon offered an important career opportunity and a permanent teaching job at the university several hours away in Poznania. He assumed, naturally, that Irena would follow. But following that path set out when she was a girl was no longer something Irena could imagine. Irena was no longer a dutiful teenager, doing what other people wanted and expected because she could not imagine other options. Duty had caused heartache already for her and for Adam. She knew she had failed as a wife, but she didn't want to be married to Mietek. Like her mother and her new friends, she was a bohemian at heart. Like her father, she was born for constant action. She didn't want to leave Warsaw and this new extended family. She was determined somehow to complete her studies and applied over and over to have her suspension lifted. And whether she said so or not, She wasn't prepared to give up whatever this burgeoning thing was with Adam. She quickly found a new job in the city's municipal welfare services with the help of Dr. Radlinska and broke the news to Mietek. She was staying in Warsaw. When Mietek went to Poznania, there was no divorce. The Catholic Church forbade divorce, and scandal would not help Mietek. But Irina did not go with him. Suspended from the University of Warsaw, and now working full-time as a social worker, Irina lived for the sake of propriety with her mother, but insofar as the rest of her life, and especially about Adam, Irina just kept quiet. That habit of secrecy later would prove to be life-saving. For 3 years, years in which Irina's workplace friendships and her romance with Adam deepened, the academic suspension remained in place. Each year Irina petitioned the administration. Each year she met with a stubborn refusal. Those in high offices on campus still remembered her rabble-rousing. It was only in 1938 when a sympathetic philosophy professor at the University of Warsaw stepped in on the sly to process the papers allowing her to re-enroll for a year that Irina had a chance to complete her studies. She made the most of the narrow window of opportunity. In the late spring of 1939, at the end of the school year, Irina submitted her final master's thesis to her advisor, Dr. Vaslav Borowy, a professor of Polish literature and culture, and was at last allowed to graduate. Adam had already qualified as an attorney, but the anti-Jewish feeling in the city, which infuriated him, had dimmed his career prospects. As far as he was concerned, he was as Polish as anyone. But the senseless laws restricting what Jews could and could not do offended his pride and patriotism, and Adam was a moody and sometimes melancholy young man. He turned inward to books and poetry and private reflections. Instead of practicing law, as both he and Irina had once dreamt of doing, Adam began doctoral work in political history with Dr. Borowy. Precisely when Adam's marriage failed, no one is certain. Even the name of his wife is only conjecture. Jewish family records in Warsaw often did not survive the occupation, and Irina's family prefers still to keep her name a closely guarded secret. All that is known for certain is that Adam's wife was one of Irina's friends from the university. A series of unlikely wartime coincidences and some old property records in Warsaw suggest that she may have been a college friend named Regina Mickelberg. If Adam's wife was not Regina, she was someone like Regina, an educated and assimilated Jewish woman from a wealthy Warsaw family. And whatever the case, Regina Mickelberg was part of their wartime circle and part of their wartime story. When the war came, Irina and her network would not forget about Regina. That summer of 1939, Irina and Adam knew, of course, that war with the Germans was coming. They were both politically aware and realistic. They had lived with the specter of European fascism and, indeed, with Polish anti-Semitism for years already. By July, Warsaw buzzed with rumors that the Polish forces were quietly mobilizing. Adam would be deployed himself by the end of August. The young people were naturally apprehensive about how the world was changing around them, but they were also all supremely optimistic and confident. After all, Dr. Radlinska had taught them that the commitment of a small group of well-intentioned people could shape the world according to their vision of it. They were about to test the limits of what was possible. When the attack on Warsaw started, it still shocked Irina. It didn't matter that she had known that an assault was coming. The wail of air raid sirens across the city awoke Irina and her mother with a start at 6 o'clock in the morning of September 1st, 1939, and her first thought was for Adam. Adam was somewhere out there on a military exercise. This was a declaration of war at last, but since spring there had been armed incursions and scuffles along Poland's western border, and the Polish army had been mobilized for battle 2 days earlier. Now Irena joined her rumpled neighbors as they poured out of their apartments and gathered in the empty streets, peering up at the sky and speculating, desperate for some explanation. From the sky came nothing, no bombs, no sounds, but still the siren wailed on. And at last, exasperated air raid guards shooed them all back inside. The anxiety and the early hour made people cross, and somewhere in the apartment complex a door slammed loudly. At the kitchen table, in their bathrobes and slippers, bleary-eyed and grim, Irena and her mother, Janina, listened to the news as it came in over the Polish radio. Irena's shoulders tensed as the crackling voice of an announcer spoke the words that everyone feared were coming. Hitler's attack on Poland had already started. Hovering over the radio, Irena leaned in closer to hear the report. The city leadership was now asking government and municipal workers to stay at their posts around the clock and to resist the German aggressors. Thank heavens. She wanted to be doing something. A look from her mother told her to at least sit down and finish her coffee. What could she do at 6 in the morning anyhow? The next hour passed slowly. Irena, stop fidgeting, her mother scolded her with a smile. Irena waited until she couldn't bear it any longer. At 7 she flew down the stairs to the open apartment courtyard, past Mr. Szezczycki's gardens. No one was worrying about the flowers that morning, and the yard was empty. Tossing her weathered old bag into the basket of her bicycle, Irena hitched up her skirt just a bit daringly, in case she had to pedal quickly. As her foot pushed down hard and the bicycle glided into motion, she turned east, toward the old town, in the direction of her office on Swota Street, with a welcome sense of purpose and determination that morning, powerfully relieved to have something to do besides wait and worry with her mother. In the office, she went to look first for her boss, Irena Schultz, a thin, bird-like blonde with a big smile. Irena Irka Schultz was more than just Irena's supervisor, though. She was also one of Dr. Radlinska's girls, and they were a tight-knit sorority. At 9 a.m., the aerial attack on Warsaw started at last. The approaching German bombers, one resident of the city remembered, at first sounded like faraway surf. Not a calm surf, but when the waves crash onto a beach during a storm. Before long, the city rattled with the constant hum of planes, tens, maybe even hundreds, and with powerful rocking explosions. Girls in the office ran for the cellars and held each other's hands tightly in the musty darkness. When the squadrons passed, the streets were in chaos. In all her 29 years, Irena had never seen anything like this devastation. But it was only the beginning. What was happening to them? Around her, private cars and hackney cabs, now called into duty as makeshift ambulances, ferried the wounded through littered streets to hospitals. The wheezy car horns blared impatiently around her, but surely the drivers could see it was useless. Where the bombs and artillery had hit buildings, the streets were filled with broken glass and piles of fallen bricks. Irena watched in amazement as flames engulfed the gutted facades of entire apartment buildings. The walls swayed and then toppled in crashes to the cobblestones around her. People pulled their coats tightly around them and hurried across the streets and open squares, seeking the safety of doorways as the skies grew dimmer. Irena coughed and covered her mouth with her scarf. Clouds of dust stung her eyes and coated the insides of her throat and nostrils. She could see dead horses in the street, killed in their traces, and sometimes mangled human bodies. Doctors and nurses helped rush moaning residents to aid points and later delivered supplies to field stations as the fighting edged closer. Fear gripped Warsaw. Across the city, one anxious thought united residents. What was it like out there, on the front lines, if this was what was happening in a city full of civilians? Irena thought about Mietek. She had said a friendly goodbye to him at a depot a few days earlier, when he had come to Warsaw for the deployment, and had wished him good luck and safety. One of her other friends from the social services office, a pro bono Jewish lawyer named Yosef Zisman had been called up as a reserve officer as well, and Irena worried about him. She would have to check in on his wife, Theodora, and their baby, Pyotr, she thought to herself. Then there was Adam. There were always thoughts of Adam. He was also in a regiment out there somewhere. The matter-of-fact question that morning in the office, in a city where a siege was clearly starting, was where to start with services. Irka Schultz was the office boss, and she called everyone together. The trouble was that suddenly everyone was one of the needy. They had never faced this kind of welfare crisis. All morning they scrambled, asking each other what to do first. Within hours, the answer became immediately obvious. Someone had to help the displaced and injured refugees already flooding into Warsaw. Someone had to find food and shelter for people bombed out of their homes in the city. The residents of Warsaw would fight to defend the city for nearly a month, and before it was all over, there were reports of the cavalry on horseback facing down modern German tanks in a desperate action that told the whole story of just how outgunned the Poles truly were. The numbers of refugees grew daily as people of the countryside and smaller cities sought safety together. They arrived on foot, tired and frightened. Women with haunted eyes told how, along dusty roads, the German planes had swung low and aimed gunfire at families pulling their belongings. Country folk working in the fields ran for the hedgerows, but on the open roads there was no cover. Irena listened to their stories and tried to keep her hands from shaking. At the time, she was a senior administrator in a branch of the social welfare office responsible for running soup kitchens across the city, and over the next few weeks she and her co-workers set up and manned dozens of makeshift canteens and shelters for the survivors. On September 24th, near the end of the onslaught, more than 1,000 German aircraft filled the skies over Warsaw in bombing raids that went on for hours and turned whole districts into rubble. For 2 more days, the devastation was unrelenting. Some of the worst-hit areas of the city included the quarter just to the north of Irena's office that ran from the Jewish and Polish cemeteries on the west to the Great Synagogue on the east. All the bombing meant wounded people. People who wouldn't make it to a canteen, but were still hungry. Where to start now? Irena knew in an instant. She sped off on her bicycle toward the Chiste Hospital on Dvorska Street, determined to find her friend Alla. The Jewish hospital was a sprawling, genteel compound not far from the Vistula River, and before the war it had boasted one of the most modern medical facilities anywhere in Europe. Now the nurses and doctors were already running short of supplies. Alla was working frantically to treat the refugees and the wounded. They were doing 30 or 40 serious operations a day, a nurse reported with a quick shake of her head, all without anesthesia. One of those patients was likely to have been Dr. Radlinska. When the bombers flew over the buildings in her district, the floor rocked beneath Helena Radlinska's feet, and she ran for the stairwell and the open courtyard. On the street, the brown dust again filled the air, and then Helena heard the first cries of the wounded trapped inside the rubble. Someone had to help them. The doctor headed back into the building just as another portion crumbled. She felt only pain and then felt nothing. Those who dragged her, moaning and half-conscious, from the ruins could see burns and broken bones that would cripple her for months. All of Warsaw suffered. There was no water, no electricity, and no food. The corpses of men and animals are heaped in the streets, one eyewitness remembered. Men of goodwill are burying the dead where they find them, in a garden or a square or the courtyards of houses. Famished people cut off pieces of flesh as soon as a horse falls, leaving only the skeleton. The German planes flew so low overhead that Irena could look up and see the pilots' faces. In the air raid shelters, the injured were piled on stretchers, crying quietly and begging for water. Everyone tried not to think of the men on the front. At home, her mother whispered urgent prayers and Irena had to admit that she, too, was praying. On September 27th, Warsaw surrendered. Exhausted, Irena and her boss, Irka, sat together in an office on Złota Street when word came that it was over. Everyone in the office was crying and hugging. The Germans and the Soviet Union had divided Poland between themselves as conquerors. The secret deal had been sealed even before the bombing ever started. In the partition of Poland, the prize of Warsaw went to the Germans, who declared it part of the Generalgouvernement, and who were even now marching into the city. Would husbands, fathers, sons, and brothers make it home? And what were they coming home to? Families across the smoldering and hungry city had 100 anxious questions. Some 40,000 people died in the bombings of Warsaw. The toll on the front lines was even more staggering. Nearly 70,000 men were dead. Another 630,000 were even now en route to Germany and the Soviet Union as prisoners of war. The Germans were never going to let all the young Polish men just go home, where they could harass the occupiers and organize an armed national resistance fighting for a free Poland. Mietek Sendler was among those captured. "We'll pray for your husband," people reassured each other. "Pray for Mietek, yes." But Irena also added a silent, fervent wish for Adam. Resistance happened quickly in Poland. It was something of a miracle, or so it seemed to Irena, who watched it take shape and flourish. Word spread quietly across Warsaw in the next few weeks. Among the countries occupied by the Germans, Poland was exceptional in several ways. Most exceptional was the fact that, in Poland, an organized and determined partisan movement took shape almost immediately, largely led by older men, by the Jewish community, and by a great number of courageous women of all ages. Some of the most extraordinary were the youngest, but Irena and, miraculously, Adam were also among them. For Adam, it was a bittersweet return to a fallen Warsaw. They had failed at the front lines, but the young people across the city were determined to keep on fighting the Germans. The groundswell of resistance was a large part of the reason why Poland was also subject to such brutal tactics of repression. Already an entire underground state was forming. First, the Polish government in exile set up headquarters in Paris. Then it evacuated to London, where it funneled financial and logistical support to home branches. As always, the problem with getting it all up and running efficiently was politics and squabbling. As a result of the squabbling, because Polish politics before the war had been no less divisive, most of the resistance efforts were organized along old party lines. That endless bickering was the result, in large part, of the country's tumultuous history and long struggle for national independence. It was only at the end of the First World War, after more than a century of foreign domination, that the Polish state was recreated for the second time in its history. But that treaty did little to settle the matter of its eastern borders toward the Ukraine, which its watchful Russian neighbors coveted. Its neighbor to the west, Germany, had other imperial ambitions. Hopelessly caught between a left-wing Bolshevik-controlled Soviet Union, around which swirled any number of wild and ugly theories about the Jewish world conspiracy, and the rise of far-right nationalism and proto-fascism on its western boundary in the 1920s and 1930s, Polish politics was Janus-faced. Which was the lesser of those two evils, the far left or the far right? It was an impossible question. In the absence of answers, people clung to their old political alliances. The atmosphere at the clandestine meetings of the Polish socialists that Irena and Adam attended that autumn was nervous but defiant. Most of the young men in the city now were Jewish, and Irena had been wild with relief when both Adam and her lawyer friend Józef made their way safely back to Warsaw. Other Polish men who were not also Jewish, were sent systematically to prisoner of war or labor camps, forced to feed the Nazi war machine. Mietek was captured and incarcerated in Germany. Jews, like Adam and Yusef, however, were unfit for any use in the eyes of the fascists. Caught up in their tangled logic of anti-Semitism, German functionaries in Berlin asked themselves what to do about this Jewish problem. If Adam and Yusef were not men but something less than human, they could pose no danger as soldiers or combatants. There could be no purpose in sending them off to prisoner of war compounds. But the Germans did not wish to live among what they considered to be a species of diseased degenerates, and there would have to be some solution. Poland was already the planned dumping ground for Jews from across Europe. While the Germans considered how best to arrange a mass forced migration, in Warsaw alone, upward of 100,000 young Jewish people like Adam were left at loose ends for the time being. And it wasn't only Adam. Yusef, Eva, and Alla were also determined activists who found themselves suddenly unemployed and idle. They too were quickly drawn into the web of these secret political gatherings. At first, the clandestine nature of things was exciting as they whispered code words at the thresholds of dim apartments or gathered in the back rooms of shops and basements. The warm camaraderie and optimism buoyed Irena's spirits throughout October 1939, and besides, it just felt good to be sitting next to Adam. "The war will be over soon," everyone said so confidently. "Perhaps until then it will not be so bad under the Germans." Irena tried to be hopeful, but evidence to the contrary was mounting quickly. The Gestapo soon began hunting those it considered troublemakers, and Irena and her friends were unmistakable agitators. A sudden noise from outside the apartment could make an entire room of people jump. The hard wooden chair beneath her creaked as Irena wriggled and tried to get comfortable during speeches that even a war couldn't make less long-winded, and Adam glanced furtively toward the door, longing for the cigarettes resting in his coat pocket. The first order of business, the leaders announced, was to deliver emergency support funds to party members and activists who were forced into hiding. They had all gone underground quickly, and suddenly those most in need included nearly all their former professors. The party needed secret couriers to keep in contact with them and funnel them money. It was a dangerous mission, and they shouldn't underestimate the risks to their own safety. Irina's heart beat faster. Of course she must help. Irina volunteered instantly. She felt a surge of affection for Adam when she saw him smiling. The professors had wisely gone into hiding when Warsaw fell to the Germans, and it wasn't because they were Jewish. Warsaw in 1939 was one of the world's most dynamic and diverse cities. There were somewhere on the order of 1 million people living in the city that year, and just over a third of them were Jewish. The remaining residents were largely, but not exclusively, ethnic Poles. The Germans, however, considered the Poles, as part of the Slavic race, to be inferior to Aryans, and ominously classified them, right along with their Jewish neighbors, as Untermenschen, or subhumans. Although the citizens of Warsaw hadn't been given a copy of the German memorandum ordering the complete annihilation of Polish culture, it wasn't a mystery to anyone in the Socialist Party or at the secret meetings Irena attended. To accomplish that cultural annihilation, killing off the country's intellectuals was the first order of business. But the category of intellectuals was a broad one. It included not just professors, but also the country's doctors, teachers, lawyers, judges, journalists, writers, wealthy landowners, industrialists, prominent businessmen, hereditary aristocrats, activists, social workers, politicians, priests, nuns, military officers, engineers, communists, and scientists. In short, an intellectual was anyone with cultural power. To cripple the professional Polish classes, Hitler gave instructions to kill all people of influence, shutter the schools and universities, and burn their libraries. Another early German memo laid out the plan for the next Polish generation clearly. The sole goal, of their schooling is to teach them simple arithmetic, nothing above the number 500, writing one's name, and the doctrine that it is divine law to obey the Germans. I do not think that reading is desirable. The response of Polish activists on the left and the right was to create in Warsaw a mirror world that matched the new German institutions, structure for structure. Patriots erected an entire underground Polish state, the one thing on which Poles from across the political spectrum were united. There would ultimately be secret Polish courts and a secret home army. The groundwork had already been laid for a secret university. Adam and Irena's thesis supervisor, Dr. Borowe, immediately joined the underground university and began work on a collaborative publishing project. He and some of the country's most eminent professors wrote, in bold defiance of the Germans, a sociological analysis of the occupiers and their crimes called Nazi Kultur in Poland, later smuggled out to publishers in Britain. Dr. Radlinska, hobbled but resolute, quickly joined the underground state and began building from her hideout a curriculum of secret university classes. So did Ala's mentor and medical research partner, Dr. Hirschfeld, and Dr. Witwicki, the Polish psychologist who mentored their friend Eva Rechtmann. These were the lucky ones, the ones who needed supporting. Helena Radlinska's brother, Dr. Aleksander Reichmann, a prominent mathematics professor at the University of Warsaw, was not so fortunate. Arrested by the Gestapo and interrogated, he was dead in the concentration camp at Sachsenhausen-Oranienburg, north of Berlin, within the first year of the occupation. He was not alone. Some 50,000 other members of the intelligentsia, and more than two-thirds of Helena Radlinska's colleagues, were ultimately executed or sent with Dr. Reichmann to perish in concentration camps. In Krakow, at the Jagiellonian University, the Gestapo arrested nearly 200 professors, the entire faculty, on the afternoon of November 6, 1939. Most died in the aftermath. Later, hundreds of Catholic priests were rounded up, in Warsaw especially. Few clergymen survived those encounters. These were the people Irena and her friends knew best. They were the teachers, mentors, political compatriots, and professional contacts in the social services and at the universities. They were the people they looked up to and wanted to become. They sometimes ran the charitable institutions that worked closely with city social workers. Sometimes they were Irena's direct colleagues. Then, after the purges, the mass resettlements began. Another 500,000 Poles were rounded up on the streets and sent to work as German slave labor. The Jewish community was not spared a share of the earliest abuses. Germans and their far-right Polish supporters, and they were numerous, in the first months of the occupation, smashed Jewish shop windows, attacked on the streets Orthodox men with their distinctive beards, and randomly beat Jews to death for sport and entertainment. In the emergency room of the Jewish hospital, on the front line of those atrocities, Ala Golomb-Grinberg struggled to make sense of it. How could this be happening? As a lead nurse in the hospital's ambulance corps, Ala was part of a triage that already seemed endless. She nursed the broken bodies of the old, whose only crime was not being quick enough to follow orders in German accents that they did not understand. For this, they were hauled feet first behind horse-drawn cabs along cobblestone streets until their skulls shattered. She saw men whose beards had been torn from their faces or hacked off carelessly with knives, and scrawny street children fighting to survive SS beatings. She kept her face calm and worked quickly. But inside, Ala thought she knew now the furious desperation of a trapped animal. Sometimes throwing open the broad sash of a hospital window, she leaned out as far as she could, sucking in the fresh air. She never thought of jumping. But everyone sometimes thought of falling. At home, Ala wrote poems on bits of scrap paper and tried to make sense of the jumbled images. And around her, everything was jumbled, no matter how much Alla and her nursing staff struggled to impose order. What had once been gleaming hospital wards now teemed with broken people. Where the artillery fire had blown out the plate glass along some walls, the windows were covered haphazardly with dusty sheets and scrap wood. By late October, the wards were already freezing in the mornings. The patched-up room mirrored the patched-up, shattered bodies within them, and at the end of her shift, her head ached from clenching her jaw in fury. But more than anything, Alla was worried and sometimes frightened. Worried about those victims of brutality, but worried, too, about her own family. Her husband, Arek, had left Warsaw with the mobilization in August. The only news they could get of him was a vague report that he had been seen somewhere on the Eastern Front in late September in bad condition. Her brother, Samuel, and his wife were already in Russian territory. Perhaps, somehow, Arek would find them? Alla also worried about her small daughter and about money. Everyone who was Jewish was suddenly worried about money. The Germans slapped crippling economic restrictions on the Jewish community with the goal of making sure that anyone who was Jewish lived in poverty. It began with forced Jewish unemployment. Jews could no longer hold any state or government positions. In the city social services, dozens of Alla and Irena's friends were summarily fired, including their friend Eva Rechtman, and a friendly old doctor they knew named Henrik Palester. Restrictions required Jewish property to be registered, their businesses Aryanized, and their bank accounts frozen. Adam fumed with indignation. In a coffee shop near his apartment on Balukskiego Street that winter, knee to knee under the table, Adam and Irena had long, urgent conversations about the future. Perhaps they considered flight. Like Alla and Arek, Irena also had family connections in the Ukraine. Maybe they could build a life together there. Hundreds of thousands of Jews, nearly 1 in 10 in Poland, wisely slipped across the Soviet border to the east that year. Those who did were far more likely to be survivors, but both Adam and Irena had widowed mothers. Irena's mother was frail. Fleeing with Janina was impossible. So was deserting her. Adam's mother, Leocadia, exasperated him, and now she talked more resentfully than ever of his abandoned inheritance. They quarreled, too, about the collapse of his marriage. But while Adam longed to be free of his mother, he couldn't abandon her either. Leaving was out of the question. In the first year or two of the occupation, some among the Warsaw Jewry said that there were limits to what could possibly happen. War was hard, of course. People understood this. Terrible things, isolated things, would happen. Others in the Warsaw Jewish community were more wary and cynical. But at the start, the Germans singled out Poles and not the Jews for systematic purges. In the first year or two of the occupation, 10 Poles in Warsaw were murdered for every Jewish resident killed. And it was considered so much safer to be Jewish that there were tales of Christian residents putting on the Star of David armband and adopting Yiddish accents during street roundups. Because the first systematic anti-Semitic edicts were primarily financial, the Jewish population was lulled into a sense of relative safety. That was precisely the intention. What Warsaw's Jewry could not know, and what Adam and Irena never imagined, was that, in a conference in Berlin on September 21, 1939, before the city's surrender, plans had already been made as well for their future. Reinhard Heydrich, the head of the Gestapo, a man whom even Hitler declared was heartless, sent instructions to commanders in Poland that month. "In reference to today's conference in Berlin," he ordered, "I once again draw your attention to the final solution." The wheels of the Holocaust were, even now, in motion. Chapter 3. Those walls of shame. Warsaw, 1941 to 1942. Behind her, Irene could hear all the sounds of Jewish life in Warsaw. The street criers calling out in Yiddish joked with each other good-naturedly, jockeying for the best corner while they hawked their wares. When one moved along, the stone streets echoed with the scrape and rattle of the iron wheels on the handcarts. She could hear in the distance the streetcar coming down Gönsche Street and the cry of gulls squabbling along the nearby Vistula River. At the doorway marked number 1, she hesitated for a moment, taking in the spiced aromas of street food and the cold air of late autumn. Then Irene softly pulled the handbell to the convent of the Ursuline sisters. The face that greeted Irene from under the starched wimple was unlined by age, and the young nun gravely inquired the reason for her visit. "I'm here to see Pani Rudnitsky, please, sister." The woman nodded silently and carefully pulled back the bolt on the heavy door. Irene stepped into the shadows of the foyer and heard the bolt drawn smoothly behind her. The young nun led Irene on through the courtyard and along the halls to an unremarkable doorway. How strange to be taken to see someone who didn't exist. Mrs. Rudnitsky was a fiction. Or, if a person with that name once lived, she did no longer, and in her death had unwittingly lent her identity to a desperate stranger. Rudnitsky was the false name under which Helena Radlinska was working from her hiding place inside this walled convent. Already, some in the Jewish community had taken the steps of securing false Aryan identity papers. With a quiet knock, Irene crossed the threshold to where her old professor was waiting, and when Dr. Radlinska warmly grasped her hand, Irene felt a flood of pleasure. For her part, Helena Radlinsky admired this young woman's bravery and spirit. But with the eyes of experience, she could see that Irene did not comprehend the risks or the dangers. Still, Helena was immensely grateful for the assistance. She needed the money if she were to impose upon the kindness of the nuns here in hiding. Over sweet, milky tea, a Polish staple, the professor told her story. Gesturing to her cane, she talked ruefully of the bombing of her apartment and the loss of all her manuscripts and her library. She talked of finding refuge there in the convent with the Catholic sisters. But looking at the sturdy walls around her, Helena Radlinska had no illusions. She knew already that the Gestapo was hunting for her. If the time came, the sisters could not save her. Never mind. She was determined to carry on fighting. There was so much to discuss, and the hours ticked by swiftly. Dr. Radlinska, cooped up and still on the mend, wanted to know everything that was happening. What was Irene doing, and what was happening? Irene had to ask herself what she was doing. The political underground was already creating a secret army, a secret government, and publishing resistance newspapers. Dr. Radlinska and the other professors, she learned, were forming a secret Polish university. One of the classrooms would be right there in the convent. But what was anyone doing in the social services? The Jews, Irene could only report, were now banned from receiving any state welfare or working in any state employment. And Irene and the professor both knew firsthand the grim consequences of poverty and unemployment in the most vulnerable segments of that population. Irene's job was doing community interviews, and Dr. Radlinska might have asked her to reflect on what she had discovered. There were families where one herring was shared amongst 6 children during Sabbath, Irene said when asked the question later. Why not build a mirror social welfare system? Dr. Radlinska was toying with the thought. It was something for Irene to consider. That would be a worthy project. That would be true to their work and their values as activists. Precisely when the cooperation between Irene and the professor started is uncertain. So, too, is the exact extent of the professor's guidance. But wartime intelligence files, kept by the underground home army on Irene's activities, document the collaboration. Irene Sendler, the files read, has large Polish contacts, especially on the left. works directly with Professor Radlinska of the Free University. Helena Radlinska was a senior operative in this underground army, and in time she would encourage several of her former students to build networks for the resistance. She would also eventually develop her own independent clandestine Jewish welfare program. And already the leaders of the resistance had a strategy. They would create as many cells as possible, all working for the protection of the movement, in complete isolation from each other. One of those cells would be run by this very capable 20-something slip of a woman, Irena Sendler. When precisely Irena and the professor talked may be uncertain, but one fact is clear. It cannot have been very long at all after the fall of Warsaw, because Irena's cell developed quickly. The need in Warsaw was urgent. Whom else to bring into the cell with her was the crucial question. Dr. Radlinska would have warmly counseled Irena to trust Irka Schultz. She was another of the professor's former students, and Irena's boss in the social welfare offices. Dr. Radlinska could also support readily the decision to bring in another co-worker and friend, Jadwiga Deneka, another one of the professor's former students. Jadwiga was a pretty blonde woman with a pixie bob, and she had trained originally as a teacher and worked in the innovative orphanage school founded by the professor's colleague, Dr. Korchak, before transitioning into the city welfare service. At 28, Jadwiga was a year younger than Irena, a bubbly and vivacious woman, and Irena knew her well from their days together at the Polish Free University and the meetings of the Polish Socialist Party. And there was a third alumna of the Polish Free University in the office, Irena's colleague and friend, Jadwiga Piotrowska. Everyone called Jadwiga by her nickname, Jaga. And like Irena, she also came from a family with an impeccable pedigree as public servants. Her father, Marian Ponikiewski, was an engineer who worked with the city welfare services designing public housing. Dr. Radlinska knew both Marian and his close collaborator, the social theorist Roman Piotrowski, and in fact, Jaga had married into the Piotrowski family. She and Janusz Piotrowski had a young daughter and a tumultuous love affair. Jaga was in her mid-30s, 6 or 7 years older than Irena, a short, sturdy woman with dark eyes, and she was an ardent Catholic. Jaga and Irena had worked together since 1934 in the city offices, and Jaga was one of the support staff working in social services on the placement of orphans. Unlike the others, Jaga was old-fashioned and deeply religious, but Irena trusted her completely. This trust in Jaga almost certainly stemmed from Irena's friendship with her younger sister, Janka. The two sisters could not have been more different. Like Irena, Janka was a bit of a free spirit. Where her sister Jaga was straight-laced and sincere, Janka was irreverent and ironic. She lived on Karolkova Street in Warsaw's Żoliborz district with her husband Józef, who had already joined the underground home army. Janka would be there that fateful morning, still 4 years in the future, when the Gestapo would at last catch up with Irena Sendler. And Janka would also take the lead in saving the life of one of their mutual friends, Regina. In that first autumn of the occupation, within weeks of the Germans' arrival, Irena turned to each of them. Resisting German rule and keeping alive the spirit of Polish independence was a matter of national pride that had the power to unify even strangers. It certainly had the power to bring together kindred spirits and four of Dr. Radlinska's girls. The friends and co-workers, Irena Sendler, Jaga Piotrowska, Irka Schultz, and Jadwiga Deneka, gathered together one evening in Irena's second-floor apartment on Ludwiki Street. At the small kitchen table, in between cigarettes, glasses of cordial, and good-natured chatter, the women decided to do something simple, a small but dangerous act of Polish resistance to the new German rulers. They would quietly circumvent the rules, they agreed, and change the paperwork, as needed, to carry on as usual to help all their clients. It was a plan without any grand or overarching vision, just a stubborn response to some practical problems, and it wasn't something they hadn't done before on occasion either. Irena was one of four conspirators, but she was their natural leader, and the decision would bind these friends together.